This is the Creative Sports Podcast.
My name is Justin Peterson,
and joining me are Karina Anglada.
Well, I might have to record with my Adobe Podcast set up later.
And Darius Thomas.
Fancy. Oh, I had to make sure I wasn't still muted.
What's good, everybody? You're listening to the Creative Sports Podcast. I'm Karina Anglada, and we are so excited to share another episode with Karen Ramming, Senior Director of Digital Innovation and Communications for Tracktown USA. This is an incredible episode, so sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
Darius, you want to do the time?
No.
All right, only Karina kidding. Can call it out then.
Only kidding.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, it's your show, Karina.
Is it, though? Okay, let's see. Hopefully my time is okay. Are you guys on the same time?
Yeah.
52.
Well, okay. A couple hours ahead 52. Of you, but other than that.
I hate it. Oh, this time thing kills me every single time. I can't. The sync, I can't do it.
It actually worked.
I feel like I was way off, but y'all go
ahead.
You were
not as far off as you think you were.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. My name is Garrett Wright. I want to start out with a big thank you to APM Music for donating the tracks we use on this podcast. Also, a reminder that this podcast is an extension of the sports creative community on Slack. So if you're hearing this and not a member of that community yet, you should head over to sportscreativeslack.com and sign up for free.
We are so excited to welcome today's guest, Karen Ramming, someone that I worked with and had the pleasure to do so, and someone who I look up to, and I know so many people in the industry look up to. Welcome to the Creative Sports Podcast, Karen.
Thank you for having me, Karina, and thank you for such a kind introduction. I can say the same about you. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, well, we've got Justin and Darius on the call, but we are so excited for this conversation, ready to talk about all things sports, all things track and field, Warriors, Pac-12, all of it. And I kind of gave a little bit of a sneak peek to your journey, but tell us about yourself and where did your journey begin in the sports industry?
Yeah, so my journey in the sports industry began when I was an undergrad at University of Oregon. I had just transferred back to UO after a failed attempt at running collegiately for a couple years. I ended up hurting myself and I transferred back to UO, decided to finish my degree there. And I had zero intention of working in sports when I was an undergraduate. And I thought that I was going to go into PR and comms in the food, beverage, and hospitality industry because I was a bartender. But I fell into an internship, but the networking is real and the world is small. And I met a couple people and they needed somebody with my interests and skill sets to help out on campus with the unofficial official student section at the University of Oregon, the Oregon Pit Crew. They're building out an entire media marketing and PR department and they needed some help with some PR and comms. So I came on to help them with that. And that was honestly my first experience in the sports world. It was the year before I graduated college. So I ended up getting about a year and a half with Oregon Pit Crew. And that's what introduced me to the sports industry and introduced me to the fact that there were career potentials in sports outside of being an anchor or a host or an athlete, because I just hadn't given it that much thought. So that's how I got my start. And that was almost 10 years ago now. Just going to age myself, but that's okay. It's been a joyous ride ever since.
Well, I mean, first of all, there's a lot there. And I love that you didn't intend to you know, be in the sports industry. And now that's been kind of the main focus of your career. But also, let's talk about running at Oregon, because that's a huge thing to do. And I know you are an avid runner and you're fast. You're really, really fast. So take us through that, right? Because it seems like you might have had a certain path and then kind of early on had to pivot. What was that journey like?
Yeah, so I never actually competed at University of Oregon. I competed at a different college. I went to UO my freshman year. I didn't want to run in college. I had been getting recruited by some schools out of high school, but I thought that I was done with it. Started my freshman year, I was on my own supporting myself with college, and out-of-state tuition at Oregon is very expensive. Realized after one term, I could not afford that, even maxing out all my student loans. So I actually contacted the running club coach, Tom Heinonen, and asked him to help me get back in shape. who whipped me back into shape. And then I reached out to, I cold emailed about a dozen college coaches. And I was just like, hey, this is my situation. This is what I've been doing. Here's like records of my recent races and workouts. And the first school that wrote me back was Tarleton State. And they were offering to cover a very large chunk of my tuition. And that's what I needed. So first time that I went down to Texas was to sign my papers. And I ran for Tarleton State for 2 years, got injured. And when I was thinking about where I wanted to finish my degree, I wanted to do so at Oregon through their PR department, because it was one of the best in the nation for a public university. So I transferred back to Oregon to finish my degree, but did not run for the O. Just got everything done in 5 years.
That's incredible. I mean, I feel like what I love about your story is, you know, we have our own plans, I think, of life, and then life happens, and then we have to pivot, and then we have to figure it out. And I love that you, first of all, that you cold emailed all of these coaches. I think that speaks volumes to your drive, right? And I know a lot of runners are very, very driven people. And I know you, beyond the running side of things, are just like very, very motivated and driven. But I love that you took the initiative, because I feel like a lot of times, you know, we let fear get in the way of our plans or what we want to do. Were you scared when you like, what made you want it? Like, obviously you wanted to run, but what made you actually like decide, okay, I'm going for all in on this?
I mean, to answer your first question, yeah, I was scared. I hate being rejected. Like everybody, I don't know anybody that enjoys rejection, but I knew that if I wanted to stay in university and not move back home, that was kind of my only option, to actually stay in school. So it was, you know, just my fear of not completing my degree, and not being able to fulfill this goal of having a college education outweighed my fear of emailing a bunch of coaches. And I am the type of person where I just fake it. So even if I didn't actually feel confident in myself to hear back and get a scholarship offer, I just faked it for as long as it took me to write the email and hit send. And so far in my life, that's been working pretty well. I would not advise anybody to follow that college plan, to be clear, either. Like, definitely reach out to like counselors or advisors. Don't just do what I did.
I mean, I think everyone's journey is there's something to be learned from. But one thing, and Darius and Justin, I actually don't know y'all's experience like getting to college either, but Karen and I have talked before, and I feel like your experience is unique based on how you grew up. And I know we've talked about our journeys, how we ended up in school. You mentioned, right, like the financial part of college that I think not a lot of people think about. Like, I wanted to go to school at a private Jesuit university in New York, and my parents were like, let's think about in-state tuition, right? Like, for the same reasons that you mentioned. So Karen, for you, I'm curious, like, what drove you and what was your motivating factor to go to college? Because it seems like that was like a priority for you, was to graduate. But I think based on what we've talked about before, you didn't have people around you in that same kind of mindset. So talk us through that.
Yeah, so I was born and raised on a small farm in Central Valley, California. My sister and I are actually first generation college students. She went to University of California at Santa Barbara. I did what I just described, split between Oregon and Tarleton State. And growing up on the farm, it's funny, whenever I tell people that, they're always like, oh, that's so fun. That's so great. And it is now, you know, now that I've moved away, I have the separation. I go back when I want. I can fully appreciate the life skills that growing up in that kind of environment taught me. I 100% respect, admire, and love my parents for what they do, and that they put their dream of being a self-sustaining small family farm first. And I appreciate and love that. It wasn't my journey. And growing up in that environment, it was pretty clear that that's just not what I was interested in. I wanted an office. I say office job. We work in sports, but you know, we all have desks. But I wanted something that was a bit more corporate focused, and I wanted to go to college and get a formal education. And I think that I wanted that because it was so different from how I grew up, and while I was growing up, I knew that, okay, this path isn't the path for me. And so, you know, I kind of looked at it like, okay, stay in the blue collar family industry or go do something that's the complete opposite and go to school. And so that's what drove me to do that. I mentioned my older sister, she went to UCSB and she's 3 years older than me. And so that kind of timing, seeing her experience in college definitely helped me. But outside of her, yeah, there weren't a ton of people in my circle who had experience navigating the college system, and especially not the NCAA system. I didn't even know what the NCAA was until I started getting recruited out of high school. And so as I kind of figured out what I wanted to do, I'm also an incredibly stubborn person. And so once I had my mindset on that, I knew that I was going to get it done no matter what I had to do. And my parents did try to, you know, talk to me about like, yeah, what about in-state schools? And what about, you know, starting at a junior college? But in my mind, I'd already decided that I was going to go to University of Oregon. And so that's how I ended up in, you know, the situation where I was maxing out my student loans and still couldn't afford it. But to be fair, I will say that year, my freshman year, that was a year that the UCs went through that crazy high tuition raise. I don't know if y'all remember that. It was like 38% or something. So the in-state tuition for a UC was the same as an out-of-state for Oregon. And that's just, you know, I know that there are other in-state schools besides the UC system, but I was like, oh, well, if I'm going to go broke anyway, I might as well do it at a school that I love.
Yeah, that's why we're all broke now, right? Because the college became big business.
Absolutely.
Pretty much.
No, I feel like we could take this in a ton of different directions. Before we get too far off the subject, though, when you relax and hang out, as someone who came up in the restaurant industry as well, what do you make yourself as a former bartender to relax and have a drink on a night out? Or a night in, I guess.
Yeah, night in, honestly, usually just red wine. I feel like I've gotten enough cocktail making in my 6 years as a bartender that I'm still kind of like, oh, do I need to do that? But I do have a fully stocked home bar. I do drink a lot of Fernet, as any true industry person does. And we tend to steer toward bourbon-based drinks. So we do a lot of like old fashions and Manhattans, something that's easy to make, easy to stir, and easy to go down.
Did you have a least favorite drink when people ask? Like, I feel literally, like there's a long list, but
anything with egg whites, hated it. And anything with muddled fruit or leaves, so like a mojito or like a blackberry margarita, because you have to like wash that shit and you have to like get all the seeds out, and it just takes so much longer. Yeah, my favorite drink to make though was always just like shot in a beer. And so now when I go out, like I'm always just like Jameson and whatever like PBR type beer you got, I'm a happy girl.
I feel like we can have a whole conversation on that as well. So
all day.
To go back to the end of your college career when you're at the University of Oregon finishing up, you know, you mentioned that you didn't want to be, you know, on camera. You didn't really want to be in the sports industry. When did that start to click in your mind of what you wanted to do? Like, when was the deciding factor for what you wanted to do in your future?
The deciding factor was, it actually happened during this event that we put on during my internship with the Oregon Pit Crew. It was called Back to Mac. And it was a rally that we put on that was ahead of one of the home basketball games at the new Matt Knight Arena that had just opened the year before. A couple of years before. And we also used it to unveil the shirts for the student section. Nike would always design these like custom shirts for us. They did shoes, and we were unveiling the shirt. And so that rally, it was a ton of work. We had hosted it at Mac Court, which was the previous basketball arena. And the idea was we get the students in, we unveil the shirt. We were using some of our most prominent student athletes at the time, like Jonathan Lloyd from the basketball team, to unveil the shirt. We distribute the shirts. We have a DJ, and then we all march from Mac Court to Matt Knight Arena for this event. I obviously helped a lot in planning that. The presidents, Brian Kalborowski and Daniel Katz, did the most of the work, but I helped a ton in terms of outreach and marketing. And at the event, it was super successful. We had about 1,000 students show up. shirts ran out, but from the PR and media side of things, we got some of our local stations to come out, and we got Pac-12 Network to come out, which was kind of a funny little foreshadowing moment. And it was in that moment when I was watching, this is going to sound so like lame to you guys, but when I was watching like people with cameras capturing something that I helped create, like that was the very cool moment for me. Like there was no reason why we had to put on that event. You know, the university wasn't telling us to do it. It was just our concept. We brought it to life. And then people thought that it was cool and interesting enough to one, attend, and two, to actually like cover and put on TV and on social media. And that was the exact moment where I was like, okay, there's a path forward in this. This is pretty addicting, like this feeling of doing something and people thinking it's cool. So that moment.
So kind of second part to that question, you get in the industry, what was the moment where you felt like you wanted to stay in the industry?
I wanted to stay. That's a good question. I feel like nobody like asks that question enough because it's tough. And there's a lot of moments when you think about leaving it. And so the moment when I knew I wanted to stay, I think it was when I got my job at the Warriors. Honestly, I had been at Pac-12 Network for 3 years prior to that. And I could talk about that experience for 2 hours, but I was ready to move on. And I thought that I had zero shot at this position at the Warriors because it's such a prestigious brand and well-known brand and team. And I ended up getting the job offer. And throughout the entire interview process, everyone that I interacted with, they were such good people, but they were also so good at their jobs and competent. And I wanted to be in that environment so badly where you're surrounded by such talented people who also just seem like chill and who you could like hang out with outside of work. And I wanted that so bad. And so when I got that position, I was like ready to like, I mean, I've always been ready to grind, but I was ready to like grind my ass off to like stay there and do like make my mark and be as successful as I could be. And during that transition period, as I was meeting my coworkers and just expanding my network in the industry and seeing like the people who are in it and the potential and where you can really go and how far your career can go, that's when I realized that I want to stay in it until I'm not having fun anymore or until I'm not seeing the career growth that I want. And yeah.
In your time as you got out of school and got into full-time jobs, you started in on the PR communication side. And it looks like when you got to the Pac-12 Network, that's when you really got into social media. I'm curious, how does the PR background and understanding influence how you approach social media today?
Yeah. So you're correct. In 2015, I had a summer position with TrackTown USA, ironically, being the PR and communications assistant. And this was, again, 2015. Social was not even like a fraction of what it is now. And so it was a line item on somebody's job rather than being an actual position. So while I was doing PR and communications for TrackTown, I was also getting their social up and running. So, you know, I was drafting press releases, managing the mix zone, interviewing athletes, and also live tweeting their events and doing social. During that time, that's when I realized that I wanted to go into social. So that's why I pivoted my path slightly. And by having the PR background, you know, the degree from Oregon, the experience working with TrackTown in the comms side, I think that it's influenced my social career pretty well. I mean, I would hope so because I'm still doing it, but because it's given me that foundation of branding and messaging, because social is a really funny space where, yeah, a lot of it is about creativity and content and making the thing that will make people's thumbs stop scrolling on their feed and actually consume it. But a lot of it is about data and analytics, and a lot of it is about messaging and positioning your company the right way. And a huge part of it is being the front lines for your company. So as shit's going down, whether it's a good or a bad thing, you're the one seeing it probably before the majority of folks in your company. And so you need to understand, you know, the impact that it can have on the company, where it needs to be routed, and what kind of response would be appropriate that fits your brand's messaging standpoint from the PR side, but also fits the social tone of voice that has been established.
We need a masterclass from you, by the way, on social strategy. No, I'm dead serious. Like, after having worked with you for so long, I'm like, I still want to learn from you personally. Like, I would sign up for a like personal webinar one-on-one just with you when it comes to social. I mean, I think you kind of mentioned it, right? Like the impact that social has. And it's interesting how it's evolved from, like you said, I love how you said it, like it was a line item now. And now there are social specific roles for certain platforms, right? So I'm curious your take on that, because you know, you have a really well-balanced understanding, well-rounded understanding of the industry. But I'm curious, like, what is your take on where we are with social, where we're going, where things are moving? I feel like it's such an ever-evolving space that it's almost tough to kind of feel like, you know, you are an expert. So do you feel like an expert? And what do you think about the current space that we're in right now?
No, I don't think I'm an expert. I don't think anybody who works in social is an expert, to be clear, because it, to your point, it's always changing. There's always something new to learn. There's always an unknown factor. There's always a platform that's coming up that's on nobody's radars. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that true expertise can really be achieved in a field that changes so, so often. There are folks that are damn good at social, and obviously I have a ton of respect for them, and they're on the front lines and, you know, the bleeding edge of developing and setting the standards in the industry. But I think that to answer your question about, you know, staffing and the role specific to each platform, I think it's interesting. I think it's great that social teams are getting larger. You know, like when I was at the Warriors and I started, there were 3 people. And by the time I left, there were 7. And we still probably weren't staffed to what we should have been.
I'm jealous.
And I don't think that any content and social team is truly staffed appropriately to, you know, manage just the influx of ideas and content opportunities and the actual output, and then evaluating it and developing KPIs and like, how does this fit with the business objectives? But I'm glad that it's getting better. And I think one of the ways that it's getting better is companies acknowledging that there are platform specific specialists and hiring them and letting them do their jobs on that platform that they've become so good at. And especially with how social is changing in the fact that nothing is a blanket piece of content anymore. There's not one thing that if you copy paste it exactly, it'll be fine on multiple channels. Part of that has to do with the algorithms and what they're prioritizing that day. Part of it has to do with how things are literally displayed on your phone. And a lot of it has to do with audience and where things are and what that audience is expecting from brands on that channel. So you have, you know, platforms like TikTok where you have to be on it, like I always say, at least an hour a day just to understand like what the hell is going on that app. And but if you do something for TikTok and you put it on Reels that day, Reels doesn't see what's going on TikTok until like 3 weeks later. So again, you can't just copy paste. And then you have platforms, you know, like Reddit or Discord that are text-based community platforms, and they're looking for conversations and like-minded and just kind of a space for them to gather. And then you have, you know, platforms like Facebook, where who knows what's going on Facebook? I don't know if anybody does. But it's just, they're all so different from one another that I think that specializing roles is a very good attempt at the path forward to like how the hell we're actually supposed to build a social team that can work on such an array of outlets with such huge audience potential for every brand.
Do you have a favorite platform, like in your personal life?
To consume or to create content for work for?
Both. Yeah, both.
To consume is definitely TikTok. I mean, that's just like obviously the easiest. And then for work, it changes, honestly, like every week. I'm not in the weeds of social anymore with my new position. And so I'm kind of just guiding like a larger digital strategy. But we've been seeing a lot of success with Reels lately. We had never put any kind of effort into video content in the past. And we've been seeing a lot of positive response on Reels specifically, but across the board on the short form video that we've been putting out. So TikTok and Reels, yeah.
So with that being said, how does a team or brand figure out the direction to go? Is it studying a lot of those platforms? And how long does it take to really find out what direction you should be going with your social strategy and execution?
Yeah, I mean, I think all of this is my opinion, but I think it all starts at the top of the business and like, what's the point of the business? Like, what is the objective here? Is it B2B? Is it B2C? And understanding why the business exists, how that applies to the internet, and more importantly, who the current and potential audiences are for the brand. Companies, like in an ideal world, yeah, a company would have a great presence on every single platform, but that's an insane amount of people that you would have to staff to make that happen. And that's just not realistic. So I think from a realistic point of view, brands should just look at, here's our current audience, here's our potential audience, here's why we exist. And with those answers, that tells you where you should be. You know, if you want to try to get a hold of like the Gen Z audience, then yeah, you should be looking at social first short form video content. If you're trying to get a hold of, you know, the moms of high school soccer players, and like Facebook is there. And I think just understanding that before diving into any kind of social strategy is the most important. And then beyond that, as a brand starts to establish the answers to those questions and where they want to be, then a lot of it is trial and error. Studying the platforms is absolutely necessary. I like to say, which I think might be controversial, I'm not sure where people stand on this anymore, that it's not smart to create content for a platform that you don't consume. And so you don't have to be personally tweeting, but you should be on Twitter. So that way, you know what people are talking about, what is going on that day, because that's such an instant app. Studying the platforms is super important, understanding how they work, how that specific demographic responds to different content, and then just trying things yourself. I also obviously recommend, you know, like networking and just talking to people within the industry who have already done a lot of that trial and error in whatever sector of the industry you're in, so that way you might be able to save some time. But yeah, know who you want to reach, where they are, and then just start seeing what's actually resonating with them. And again, just being really realistic and managing up internally as much as possible to get the resourcing that you need, to be very upfront with your boss who might have gotten their start in the industry before social media was even a thing, and just clearly communicating, like, if you want us to reach this thing, this is what we actually need and why, so that way you can actually be successful.
I like the way that you said that, and I'll be completely honest. I didn't, you know, I worked in the college industry for quite some time and never once heard, you know, whether it's B2B or B2C, and I'm not sure if a lot of people working in those spaces even today understand the value of knowing what those are.
Or KPIs or...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Like there's actual thought put into the direction.
Right. Yeah. And so a lot of it seems like, and it may not just be the collegiate industry, but just worldwide, of if you don't understand what you're trying to satisfy, you're just throwing gum at the wall. So, you know, expound on that a little bit more of how you decide what's more important for, I know money is always, and revenue is always important. So revenue generating things matter. So when do you decide B2B? When do you decide B2C? And how do you kind of approach and attack that?
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that there's a lot of places where it's like, we should be on social, so we're on social, and it's just putting stuff out there. And so highly recommend taking a step back and figuring that out. And social is funny because every other department is a stakeholder in social in some capacity. In all my roles, I've worked with every single department, because ticketing, they want to use social to sell tickets. And even though organic social does not sell tickets, organic social does develop the audience that can be used to target ads to sell tickets. And, you know, PR wants to get their releases out and they want more people to know about this, but they don't, you know, then we're not going to put a press release on Twitter. And so working with them to kind of like modify their language and make it social friendly. And so understanding first that social media will have a stakeholder in every department, just depending on what the initiative is for the business that day, that week, that month, or that year. And even taking a step back from that, understanding that, you know, the larger business objectives are going to dictate social strategy and social objectives. So you mentioned the collegiate space. Almost every single college that I've either worked with, worked for, or talked to, tickets. Like that's what they want. Ticketing and recruiting, depending on if you're talking to front office versus coaches. And so understanding that those are the priorities for the athletic department, that is going to help inform the kind of content you should be creating, where you should be focusing, whether you should be doing general audience development that they do paid targeted ads for, or trying to connect with folks directly on organic social to do a call to action for them to buy tickets, whether your stuff should go on LinkedIn. It is a very funny space, but in college specifically, yeah, it's like tickets and recruiting are a good balance, and or not a good balance, but that is kind of the top two that I've seen. And you learn what the priority objectives are by talking to other people, you know, because there might be a day on social where, yeah, it's a release about a new group that your company is starting, but then also tickets are going on sale. But then also you have this like hype video that's supposed to go out. And so you need to get an understanding of priorities from the folks who are setting the overall business objectives. That way, you know, like what's actually the most important to help inform distribution and timing, and maybe even like pushing a couple of things on social one way or the other.
I feel like so much of this is like, and you kind of alluded to it, but you have to take a step back from everything. And I think a lot of times as creatives, we don't always think about the business side of things. We just think about being creative, creating something from nothing, watching it evolve. But we don't take that step back, like you said, and think about, okay, what are the business objectives of my team? What is the point of this project that I'm working on, and how will it point back, right, to those business objectives? I feel like I talk with a lot of young people that kind of get lost in the mix, and it's like, I want to do this type of content, or I want to do this type of project, and it's like, yeah, that's cool, but like you have a job for a reason, right? And like sometimes we have to take that step back. I've had to take it back myself at times, because you get like too like stuck in your ways and stuck in your own little tunnel vision, not realizing, okay, there's all these other like tentacles of the business, like you mentioned. So I love the way you broke all of that down. You mentioned earlier, you know, in the roles you've had and with the Warriors, part of the reason why you wanted to work with that team was because you felt like it would be a really great growth opportunity. You were working with lots of other people who are experts. What in general drives your career growth, and what has led you now to Tracktown USA?
Yeah. So, I mean, what drives my career growth is my own pride and ego. Like, I want to be good. I want to be really good, and I want to be really successful. And, you know, I work for organizations that I'm proud to be a part of, but at the end of the day, this is my career, and I want to make sure that I'm prioritizing my own development throughout my entire career and journey. I don't know why I want to be successful. I think I've never really understood the concept of enough in my life, and that kind of applies to my career as well. And what drove me to Tracktown USA. So I had mentioned, you know, I had that summer position with them in 2015. I had also started just doing one-off event work for them in 2014 when I was an undergrad. Tracktown USA is an event organizing committee. And so they put on the premier track and field meets in the United States. So Olympic Trials, Prefontaine Classic, USA Championships that are at Hayward Field at University of Oregon. So when I was an undergrad, I got connected with them. They needed literally a camera switcher for one of the meets. And so I was up there switching cameras, and that was my job.
Hey, directing.
Yeah. But that's how I got connected to them. And from there, literally since 2014, every single summer, I ended up working with them in some capacity, whether it was getting flash quotes, doing social, managing the mix zone, because I love track and field, obviously, as a college athlete. And I just got a good vibe from them. I wanted to do something that would better the sport while still advancing my own career in a full-time capacity at Pac-12 and GSW. And so when I decided to go to Tracktown USA about 6 months ago now, full-time, I had spent a lot of time talking with Michael Riley, who's the CEO. He and I have known each other since 2014. We followed each other's careers really closely. And he and I were just talking about where the company was going, what the new objectives for the company were. You know, they've been around for 10 years at that point. Event organization is their bread and butter. They can do logistics in their sleep. They can put on an event for tens of thousands of people in their sleep. And he wanted to put more of a focus on content and marketing and that side of things to grow the sport. Something that you'll hear me say a billion times if we keep talking about track and field is growing the sport. It's the most popular sport in terms of participation in high school, but a lot of people don't realize that there's actually a professional circuit and that people are competing professionally every single year, not just in the Olympics. And so I knew in my heart that I was going to end up in track and field full time in some capacity. I just didn't know how or when. And when Michael and I were talking about this opportunity, it felt right. I had learned so much from my time in collegiate athletics and at the Warriors about all things content, comms, putting on events, brand management. And I'm not done learning by any means, obviously, but what I learned from those other sports and those other organizations, I felt like I could have a positive impact on the sport that I personally care about the most. And so the timing felt right for me to go back and join the team full time and build out my own team and try to make a positive impact in the sport in our little corner of it. Especially coming off of last summer, 2022, the World Championships were hosted in Eugene at Hayward Field for the first time ever in the United States. And so there was already momentum coming off that. And then this year, we're hosting the Diamond League Final. The Diamond League is a professional worldwide track and field circuit that gets competed in. We're hosting the Diamond League Final for the first time ever on U.S. soil. So kind of catching the wave of coming off of Worlds and then riding it all the way through the Diamond League Final just was a great opportunity to like really apply myself and what I learned and build out this team to see what we can actually get done.
I could sit here and talk track and field with you all day because I have a big affinity for the sport. So when you think about growing the sport, you know, when you think about the Olympics and, you know, how big that is, and people have been, you know, for track, it hasn't been as broadcast as much like year round. So how excited are you to see that kind of thing starting to happen, you know, bringing the Diamond League to the U.S., bring the World Championships? How exciting is that for other people who aren't as immersed into track and field all the time to actually be able to give them that opportunity to find interest in the sport?
Oh, it is so exciting. I have already started harassing so many of my friends to get to Eugene for at least one of our events this summer, because I'm like, listen, it is growing. There's a lot of stuff happening and you should get in now because it's a very exciting time and the potential for the sport to become, I don't want to say it'll be one of like the big five sports. I don't want to like put that kind of like onus on it, but it is gaining a ton of popularity in the United States. And I love the fact that I can be the one to introduce some people to it in my own circle and some other people to it more widely on the internet. But I think that it just has such huge potential in terms of relatability, you know, like a lot of people in the country can run, a lot of people can throw something, and a lot of people know how to jump. And so there's the relatability aspect that a lot of other sports don't have. It's also, you know, at its base level, pretty easy sport to understand. Whoever runs the fastest, throws the furthest, jumps the highest or farthest, that's who wins. And that's it, you know? There's obviously a bunch of nuances to it when you really get into it, but it's easy to enjoy a track meet because there are people who are competing to their highest ability for this 10 second race. And it's just all in right there, that moment. And it's all focused. And so when you're at these events and you're feeling that, it's a pretty addictive sport because you have the crowd and you have the athletes, and the athletes are so raw and passionate. And I think it's one of the sports where, maybe except for soccer, where they do nothing to try to hide what they're feeling, whether they're sad about something, disappointed in their performance, or whether they're ecstatic because they just made an Olympic team that they've been working their entire lives toward. They don't try to hide any of that emotion. And so outside of the actual athletic achievements of the sport, just that kind of raw vulnerability that you get from the athletes immediately, time and time again, after every single event at a meet, it's incredible. And I think that that is what has huge potential to really crack the US market and to help people resonate with these athletes, with the sport, and why it matters outside of the Olympic cycle.
And to even add more to that, visibility, you know, in years past, in decades past, like, visibility was solely based on, you know, TV contracts, TV, TV, TV. But now with all the streaming capabilities, does that make it easier for the visibility of the sport as well as, you know, spreading that out? Because some of that, the reason that the sport may have not seemed as popular has to be with people not having the access to actually be able to see what is going on.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, obviously keeping things to just TV is going to limit the growth of anything, regardless of whether or not it's sports. And so I'm really, really happy that the sport has adopted streaming so heavily. You know, specifically companies like Runnerspace, who I swear they're like streaming like every single meet now. And if you have a Runnerspace account, like, you can watch so many meets across the country. And, you know, companies like Tracklandia and Portland Track, they're putting on a bunch of meets that are streaming for free because they just want people to watch the sport they love and to really understand it. And it's those kinds of initiatives where you're making the sport more accessible and you're lowering the barrier of entry to the sport. That is going to be huge in terms of its growth. I will say the downside to that is that there's, you know, about 18 different streaming subscriptions that you have to subscribe to. I think it's Kyle Merber or something did something where he totaled up the monthly subscription cost to watch all the track and field meets. And it's expensive because it is spread so thin. So it's definitely, you know, two sides to the coin there, but we're figuring it out. The sport is trying to figure it out. And I think in the meantime, yeah, like, more cameras on the sport, it's more opportunity for people to consume the sport. That's always going to be a net positive.
What was your event, your main event that you ran that was your specialty? And does that also translate to your favorite race or event to watch?
So I was middle distance and distance, so like 800, 1500, and then if you do 800 and up, you have to run cross country because that's just how it is. Darius, is that you too?
Yes, I did 800, 1600, 3200 in high school.
Excellent. It's a good event group. People call us masochists, but we call it fun. Oh,
the 800 especially,
it's a tough race,
that
but
is
fun.
It is hard. It is a sprint, like, full out. Like, I'm dying every time I ran the 800.
It's the perfect race of endurance and speed.
You race a 400 and then you just hold on and pray. and it kind of translates to my favorite. This is going to sound so morbid, but I love at the end of Maltese, the last event for the decathlon, it's a 1500, and for the heptathlon, it's 800. And I need to get inside the mind of whoever decided that that was going to be the last event for these athletes. But
that part
at the end of it, it is just like, I talk about emotion, like, it is carnage on the track. Bodies are strewn everywhere. Everyone is so just grateful to be done. Like, it's such a wild experience to witness, like, streaming or in real life. And it really is just like the epitome of what track and field is, which is just, you have to be the best you can possibly be for this very focused short amount of time. And those athletes are just holding on after already completing 7 or 9 events, and they have the longest event that they have to do at the very end. And just, I love watching that. I know that might make me sound like a sick person, but I think that there's something really, really beautiful in the carnage that happens.
That does make you a sick and twisted. No, I'm totally kidding. We're all messed up in our own way, for sure.
It's definitely fun to watch, just to see how anyone could be above average in multiple events and having to sustain to be good enough in that many things to compete for, you know, a championship or a win at a race or, you know, whatever. It's very interesting to watch.
Yeah. And it's I'm going to give a very short plug here, but one of the athletes that we're working with for our All Access series that we're doing this summer called Road to Tracktown is Anna Hall, who's the American indoor record holder in the pentathlon, because it's indoor. And she is that person, you know, like she is above average in every single event, but she's also like at NCAAs, she did the heptathlon and then she went back and did the open 400 meter hurdles and she got second still. And so the fact that she's so good at her seven events and that she's that good at an eighth event, it's incredible. And so as we've been working with her, I was like, how the hell, like how much of this is just God-given talent and how much of it is work ethic? And she is just a remarkable person. She's very talented, but the work ethic that she has, she's at the track constantly. And she's so critical of herself while still maintaining such positivity about the potential for her career and season. Like she's just, and that's the kind of mindset that you have to have to, yeah, be a good Maltese athlete. Like you have to know, she has a checklist of like 18 things that she wants to improve on for her next event. And she's able to do that while still being so good at everything. It blows my mind. I'm not that kind of person, but I'm glad that she is.
I was going to say, I'm excited to watch that All Access series. That sounds really, really cool. And also, I want to know what's on that checklist of 18 things, because I feel like, you know, I'm a checklist person and, you know, most of it is like what I need to do. But I think we all strive in our own way to grow and evolve in what we do. And I think a lot of times, like, it's cool to see athletes in particular, because it's like on a different level. So that's awesome. I'm looking forward to that All Access piece and
yeah,
series.
I'll send you the link.
Same.
I felt like I heard a little bit of a generalist for specialist, like the conversation that we have in creative when you were just talking about the, what'd you call them, Maltese, like multi-event athletes. And just the idea that you can be really good at a lot of different things is interesting. And I feel like a lot of us build that over time, though. And I feel like I've heard that in your story, how you did PR and got into social, and you started in track, and you know, took it upon yourself to make sure that you got through college without having a ton of debt, and realize that. I'm wondering how much of that actually goes back to your childhood of being raised on a farm, because I grew up, I wish Brock was here, because he would talk about his small town that he grew up in, Nebraska. But just that mentality and the work ethic and the pushing yourself and the challenges that if you helped out around the farm that you faced and had to, you still had to get up every morning because nothing was done for you. I'm just curious if you feel like that plays a role or what kind of role that played in how you approach what you do today.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely give all credit to the farm and my parents for developing my work ethic. To your point, the farm is land and there are animals, there are plants. If you don't get up every morning and get out there and do it, nobody's going to do it for you. You know, there's no safety net, there's no backup. If you neglect something for a couple days, that crop could be dead or those animals could be dying. And so that definitely instilled the work ethic that I have. You know, like over the summers, I was running cross country for my high school, and we would have these like official, unofficial, I think that they weren't supposed to be happening, but it was like a community run, but as our practice over the summers. And I would, you know, we'd wake up and I'd harvest for like 30 minutes or an hour with my family, and then I'd go to practice, I'd run. I would definitely try to like delay coming home because then I had to go back to work, but then you get back to the farm. You help finish harvest to go sit at the roadside stand and work there for a couple hours because we'd sell some of our stuff there whenever it got too hot to actually be out in the field. And, you know, then you finish up anything that you need to do after dusk when the sun's gone down, and then you go to sleep and you do it again. And that definitely is where my work ethic came in, and just the idea of like putting in as much as you can to get something out. Me and my siblings, something that my parents did with us was once we all turned 16, we were all supporting ourselves financially. So we would have, you know, certain hours that we needed to work on the farm. And then outside of that, we had a spending sheet. And so, you know, tracking how many hours and doing that for like equitable pay kind of thing. But then we were also babysitting outside of it. We were doing a lot of stuff on the side because we were on our own financially from the age of 16. And so that kind of forced you into having a work ethic as well. But I think a lot of us were just like born with like the hustle idea in our heads too. Like I remember when I was like 5 years old, me and my siblings, we really wanted to go to Disneyland because everyone was going to Disneyland. It was like an 8-hour drive south and we hadn't been. And my parents were like, well, we can't afford to go to Disneyland. And we said, well, what if we got the money? I was five. It was my oldest brother probably saying all of this, not me. But basically they're like, yeah, if you guys raise whatever, however much money we needed, we can go to Disneyland. And so me and my siblings, after we were done working for the day, we would take any of the tomatoes that didn't go to the wholesaler and we would go set up like a folding table next to the road. And we just had a sign and we were like selling tomatoes to like people who drove by. And we ended up raising enough money, like earning enough money from doing that. One, to take a vacation with our family, but then also for my parents to realize, oh, they're actually making substantial money just selling direct to consumer. And so that's when they stopped doing wholesale too. And so like things like that just comes with the territory, nurture and nature, but the farm is definitely where work ethic gets developed, for sure.
It's funny you say that with April being financial literacy month. Like,
oh, is it really?
Yeah. Even though this will play in, is this a May episode, Justin?
Yeah, I think it's the first is the next Monday.
Okay,
right?
So we're gonna tie two things into one here.
What a great transitioning point,
yes.
Darius. That was fantastic.
Great transition. So with April being Financial Literacy Month and May being Mental Health Awareness Month, at what ages, like kind of thinking back, I know you talked about being 5 years old and wanting to go on a family trip. Like, who did that kind of mentality come from? And when did you start to pick up on it personally?
Yeah, I mean, I think my parents were always super, super open about money. We did not have a lot of money growing up. We were like well below the poverty line. And so they were always really open and honest with us just about, you know, why we can or can't do things. And just this is why we work so hard, because we need to get by. And so it's always been relevant for me. And it's always been a huge, huge factor in a lot of things that I do. And it's also been a huge source of anxiety. I still have a lot of anxiety about money. And I don't know at what point I'm going to actually feel financially secure. I don't think I ever will. And that just stems from growing up like that. But I will say, you know, the benefit to that is that I grew up poor. I know how to be poor. So if anything happens, done it before, I can do it again. And it introduced me to just the fact that I can't and don't use lack of money as a crutch. And instead, you know, I have an expectation for my life and I'll work as hard as I need to meet that expectation because I know how. And so I just kind of grew up with that mentality and mindset. And then when I was going to college, after I got hurt, I was bartending full time while I was taking classes because it was, you know, lucrative and flexible. Even after I graduated, I moved to San Francisco, and for the first 2 years, I couldn't afford rent in a room. And so I was living in a living room. Like, me and my friends got an apartment and they were fine with me just having the living room be my bedroom. I was living on a fold out couch. And I was working at Pac-12 just like part-time hourly freelance while still bartending to make ends meet. And I was just working way too much because I, again, had that expectation. I knew what I needed to do to meet it. Was it good for my mental health? Hell no. I had so many breakdowns, and I'm still getting to a place where I feel like, you know, good and stable, and I don't need to grapple with my anxiety as much. But that's just how it was. And if I wanted to get to where I am today and keep going to where I want to go 10 years from now, then I just deal with it as it comes.
That's a great way to put that, because a lot of people who, you know, the buzz phrase now, I won't say buzzword, but the buzz phrase now is work-life balance. But for some people who grow up the way that you did, and I have some similar experience with that as well, is growing up not having, and so you kind of build this mindset to, I have to work to get to a certain place. So with all that being said, and with your history of that, how do you deal with the mental anxiety, like in these times, to kind of cope with that? Because you'll probably never fully get over it, right? So how do you approach that? And what are some things that you do to kind of address and kind of calm that?
Not well. I'll start by saying that. It's a process. It's a process. I'm a lot better than I was 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. And I think part of the growth in that space for me has, one, been surrounding myself with people who can help me on that. So like Nate, my boyfriend, he is very, very good at putting things into perspective for me, especially when it comes to work. He's a software engineer. He's been in the tech space his whole career. And so our areas don't intersect a lot. And just having him be with me, we live together. And so having somebody that I live with who's outside of my world, who I can have a conversation with that's not related to my job, is huge for my mental health and just kind of keeping things in check. You know, even when I was working for the Warriors, and at the time it was the 12th largest sports brand in the world, we had 60 million followers, it was a ton of pressure. And he just, you know, he went to NBA games when his friends wanted to go, but otherwise it wasn't his thing. And so he didn't follow the team super closely. So having people like that who support me and my ambition and what I want to do, but keep things in check for me and really remind me that there is a whole world outside of this bubble that we're in the sports industry, has been really important. Outside of that, I do a lot of baking because I can still have my phone. I found that a lot of people are like, oh, unplug. If I try to like fully unplug and I don't have internet connection or my cell phone, my anxiety gets worse because I'm just imagining what could happen. And so I am finding hobbies that I can still be available if shit hits the fan for whatever reason, like baking, or when I go running, I have like my Apple Watch just in case something happens. I know that that's not the goal. The goal is to be able to leave my phone at home and go away and not be stressed. I'm not there yet, but getting there. And besides that, I like weed and it really helps me relax. And so we have a little vape pen and we make some edibles. And at the end of the night, when I am forcing myself to like chill out and wind down, then that's usually what I do. But yeah.
I love all of that. And especially the part of being where you are with your phone and finding hobbies that work for you. I feel like a lot of times we put pressure on ourselves to like either conform or do what everybody else is doing or right, completely unplug. And it's like, that might not work for you. What works for somebody else might not be efficient or effective for me. And so I love that you found and are finding things that are working for you and also doing things that you're enjoying while still, you know, maintaining that lower level of anxiety. Like if that's what works, that's what works, right? So I love the way you broke that down. That's awesome.
If you were to go back and do your career again, like if somebody is getting into this and wants to follow in your footsteps, so to speak, even though they won't be able to because you were part of a early adoption for social media and got in on the ground floor of that. But if they wanted to follow what you do today, and what advice would you give them?
I would say three things. I would say one, network. I know that everyone says network, but like it is true. Like the sports industry is small and we're all probably 2 degrees of separation from each other. And if you want to get into the sports industry, the creative space, networking is so, so important. If people are still in college, then, you know, leveraging their professors' relationships. Like I'm still really close with one of my college professors. She brings me in for guest lectures and to connect me with students and all of that. And I love doing that. And every single professor has alums who are like that. And so if you're still in college, talk to your professors, develop those relationships. If you're out of it, or even if you are in college, just reach out to people, Twitter, LinkedIn. I haven't met anyone who works in this industry who's unwilling to talk to somebody who wants to break into that. And after you have that initial call, you know, if things are going well and you're vibing, then stay in touch with that person. Like, I've met maybe like 100 people who are like, oh, can I pick your brain about getting in the industry? And maybe 4 of them are still in touch with me. But the ones that are still in touch with me, you know, like we're talking to each other and they have questions about their career and I try to answer them and I introduce them to people to help them. And so developing that really strong network is super, super important. The other two are semi-related. The second one is say yes to as many things as you possibly can. I'm going to caveat this with, I personally think that unpaid internships are unethical. So if you can do things that are compensated, I highly go that route, please. People should be paid for their work. But say yes to as many things as you can, especially if they aren't exactly in line with what you want to do when you're early in your career. You know, saying yes to something that's like tangentially related to your career goals is going to open more doors in the industry to help you network, but it also might expose you to a different side of the industry that you might actually be more interested in. So if you think that you want to be, you know, a social media manager, but somebody's saying, hey, we need somebody to help us out with this live stream, say yes to that and like learn how to live stream. And then you could be like, oh, wow, I actually really want to be a live stream producer. Or, okay, well, I don't want to do that, but now I know how, so I can add that to my skill set. I did that a lot early on in my career. Pac-12, they had me like out there with like a camera. I'm not a videographer. I was never a videographer, but I did it because I wanted to learn how. So that way, as I was advancing my career in the space, I wanted to have a basic understanding of all the different elements of it. So that way I could appropriately like lead a team and manage. And so saying yes to as many things, getting as many skill sets as you can is so important. And then really finding that area to focus in on as you get a little bit more into your career and you start actually climbing the corporate ladder, doing whatever you want to do. That's where you kind of specialize. And then the last one is related to that is just, you're always going to be learning. And so, you know, an ego check is definitely necessary. It's like, especially in the digital space, things are changing so frequently. You have to be open to learning. You have to be open to learning from your peers, from people younger than you, from people older than you. And we're all helping each other out because we all need to if we want to be successful. So just having that kind of open mind and that willingness to learn from other people and to share your knowledge. Like, I'm an open book. I don't hide unless it's like an NDA or something. I don't hide what I've learned. If somebody asks me if they want to know how to make a Twitter video card or whatever, like obviously I'm going to show them. So just the constant learning, being open to that.
All such incredible, incredible advice. I'm like, I wish I had that advice like 10 years ago.
I don't think any of it is like new or special, but you know, it's always good to repeat.
No, for sure. It's super valid. And you've shared so much incredible insight today. We appreciate you for joining us and having this awesome conversation. And we are so excited to tune in to all of the work you do with Tracktown USA.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. This was so fun.
I think the only thing that, one of the things that I just, again, this was like interesting to me listening to you speak, was like, and you said it, the foreshadowing of your career, right? Like you went to Oregon and then ended up at Pac-12, and then Pac-12 was involved during that first event that you took us through. And then, you know, I don't know if there was any foreshadowing with Warriors, but there was foreshadowing of Tracktown USA. Like I love, was there foreshadowing for the Warriors position? Do you feel like that's just like a common theme of your career?
I think that there actually was a little bit. I was thinking about this the other day. So when I was in San Francisco working for Pac-12 and I was bartending at a bar called Bullet that was on Polk Street. Huge party bar, is so much fun. And we would do like watch parties for when Warriors were in playoffs. And while we were doing the watch parties, the Warriors Community Foundation had reached out and they wanted to, we set up like a thing where we had a Papa Shot hoop and they gave us like bobbleheads and freebies. And then we would charge like, it was $1 or $5 like per shot. And then when you took a Papa Shot, you also got a Jello shot kind of thing. And we donated all that money to Warriors Foundation. So there actually was like a little bit of foreshadowing there, which is pretty funny, but yeah.
That's wild. I don't know. I love stories like that, because I feel like, you know, when you look back, hindsight is always 20/20, but in the moment you're like, oh man, like this is, you know, why that happened, or I met that person, it connected me to this, right? Like you said, the 2 degrees of separation. So it's the small world. That's amazing. Your journey is truly, truly awesome. And I really appreciate you being so candid and sharing, you know, with some real honest answers, you know, that I think for some people it's hard to talk about that. So your journey is amazing. Thank you for sharing with us, and thank you for spending time with the Creative Sports Podcast.
Of course. Thank you guys.
Well, thank you so much for making Creative Sports Podcast part of your day. We'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, and suggestions. So pop on over to the sports creative community on Slack and connect with us and your fellow creatives. If you're enjoying this podcast, we'd love it if you shared it with a friend or a coworker, and leave us a 5-star rating so other people will be able to find us as well. And don't forget to subscribe so that you're the first person to catch each new episode. Remember, the world needs your voice, so keep creating.